Be seated, everyone. Good afternoon. This is the time set for the oral arguments. We have three cases today. The first one is Jennifer Crozier versus Garrett Crozier. We have the appellant here through his counsel, Mr. Cardenas, and also the respondent through his counsel and Ms. Cohen. Okay, and the person helping you today. Okay, welcome to you also. You don't probably get a whole lot of chances to go to court, so we're happy to have you here too. I'm joined by my two colleagues on the Court of Appeals, Judge Bonnie Bullitt to my left and Judge Deborah Westbrook to my right. We're very much looking forward to hearing the arguments in this case today. Mr. Cardenas, you go first. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal? 3 minutes. Okay, and Judge Bullitt, do you want to say anything before we officially start?
Thank you all for being here. We really appreciate the attorneys who take cases pro bono. It's important to have that representation, and we are very appreciative.
Judge Westbrook?
I echo Judge Bulla's sentiments about the pro bono work and appreciate everyone's assistance.
It just so happens we have three family law cases today. So you're free to stay for all of them if you want to. But every single one of them is important. We put a high priority on cases involving children, and having the argument really helps guide us towards the best result we can get in a case. All right, Mr. Cardenas, you can go first.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Scott Cardenas, and I represent the appellant in this matter. This appeal centers on a district court's custody order regarding primary physical custody of three minor children. Ultimately, the district court decided to award primary physical custody of the youngest minor child to respondent who lives in Colorado, while allowing the two older minor children to remain here in Nevada with appellant. Now, in making that determination, the district court erred in two critical ways. First, the district court failed to conduct any best interest analysis at all in its custody order. And second, the district court failed to consider the evidence of abuse that was described in the child interview report, which included abuse from respondent that the children described, such as one of the children being kicked in the stomach with steel-toed boots to the point that she urinated on herself, the children described being struck in the face, which caused her to fall to the floor and hit her head on a bed frame. They described, you know, spanking to the point that it left bruises. So descriptions of abuse like this. And so based on those errors, the failure to conduct a best interest analysis and the failure to consider the abuse, appellant requests that this court reverse the district court order with instruction for it to conduct the analysis required under the statute. So turning to the first issue, the district court failed to make any findings regarding the best interest factors outlined under NRS 125.0035 subsection 4. Both this court and the Nevada Supreme Court have been very clear that any custody order is required to include specific findings and for the court to tie those specific findings to the best interest factors outlined under the statute. And here, the district court failed to do that. The district court's custody order does not even mention the best interests of the children. It does not even attempt to engage in a best interest analysis at all. And really, these best interest findings are critical for several reasons. One is that for our purposes on appeal, there's no way for this court to engage in a meaningful review of the order if there's not specific findings. I believe that the language from the case law says there's no way for this court to determine whether the custody determination was made for appropriate reasons, right? And so here there's no findings that allow that kind of review. Secondly, for the parties moving forward, it makes it impossible for appellant or respondent in the future to, move for modification and show that there's been a substantial change in circumstances, because there's not a custody order by which, they could show kind of a starting point for that analysis to show that there has been some kind of substantial change. when there's no custody order at all with any kind of findings.
This court mentioned that scenario in the Roe versus Roe opinion, that you have to have something clearly stated so you know where you're going from there.
Correct, correct, exactly. Yeah, there has to be findings from the district court related to the best interest. And as this court and the Supreme Court have echoed, you know, the best interests are the paramount concern in any custody determination. So the district court is required to engage in that analysis and to include that analysis in the custody order, which was a failure from the district court in this case.
Is it still your position, counsel, that the district court erred in failing to find changed circumstances because it was modifying custody?
So, I think that the record kind of makes it a little confusing in that regard as far as what the procedural posture of the case was. I think that it would be okay to consider this as an initial custody determination because there was, you know, no final custody determination entered from the Utah court or from this court, which we mentioned in our opening brief. That is another ground that could potentially be error is the district court viewing this as a modification. But we provide that analysis in our brief since that's the way that the district court analyzed it. But I think, you know, under either analysis, really the arguments that we've made in the opening brief stand on their own since it relates to both the best interest factors as well as the rebuttable presumption relating to the abuse that had gone on in this case.
So with respect to the rebuttable presumption, is it your position that we can find in the first instance on appeal that that presumption has been triggered and was not rebutted where the district court didn't conduct any analysis below?
Right. I know that typically, you know, this court does not want to be the court to make findings in the first instance. But, with the record that is before this court in this case, I think that everything shows that the court should have applied that rebuttable presumption, right? Because what we have here is we have the report from the children or the report that included statements from the children describing the abuse that they suffered. And I believe respondent himself in the answering brief describes this as the most relevant evidence of abuse. I think that was the language that they used. I don't want to misquote, but you know, I think we agree on this characterization that the report is the most relevant evidence of abuse that went on this case. So, you know, on one side of the scale, you have the most relevant evidence of abuse. And then on the other side, you have absolutely no attempt by the respondent to refute the allegations of abuse that were described in the report. At no time during the evidentiary hearing did respondent testify in a way that would refute or undermine the statements of abuse. Respondent did not, you know, put forward any witnesses that undermined the statements from the children and the abuse that they described, both physical and verbal. And the district court itself, when it was in a way kind of conducting the hearing and controlling the questioning, did not elicit any testimony or inquire into the abuse that had gone on. So all of the evidence that is in the record right now, tilts the scale in the favor of showing that there was evidence of the abuse, or everything that we have related to the abuse shows that the district court should have applied to that rebuttable presumption.
Was the Utah conviction, and I believe there was one, was for child abuse or neglect or both?
Yes, it was for child abuse. It was related to the abuse that was described in the report by one of the children. And that was a no contest plea. And I know there's been an argument about, you know, the district court's consideration of that, but that conviction was considered by the court in the past. It was filed multiple times and there was a no contact order that was entered. So even if, you know, this court agreed with the argument the respondent makes in the answering brief, I think that argument has been waived because it was never raised before the district court, and the district court considered the abuse that had gone on in the conviction in prior orders.
Counsel, isn't it accurate to say that what was actually in the record were minutes from the district court in Utah? It wasn't actually the conviction.
Correct. So I think that's another grounds as well, is that the conviction itself wasn't entered. It was the minutes kind of describing what had gone on related to the Utah conviction. And I think it's important to note that, I don't think that we have to get too hung up on kind of the arguments surrounding the conviction, when even if we take that out of the picture, we still have the statements directly from the children in the report about the
counsel,
abuse.
Can we consider those statements? The children were not present and their statements that were made outside of court. So can they be used to prove the truth of the matter asserted for the district court to have applied the presumption in this case?
Right. Yes, I think they can in this case, because the district court at the outset of the evidentiary hearing stated that it was going to consider that report and that it was going to admit that report into evidence, which it did during the evidentiary hearing. And there was no objection raised to that in addition to no attempt by the respondent to refute the statements of abuse that were described in that report. And you know, this court has made clear in cases like Nance v. Ferrero that it is the district court's responsibility to consider evidence of abuse, and that it is an abuse of discretion for the district court to ignore that evidence. I believe the language from this court in that case was that it, quote, flies in the face of, you know, established Nevada law, that it is presumptively not in the best interest of a child to be placed into the custody of an abusing parent. So, you know, this factor related to the abuse weighs more heavily than any other factor in the best interest analysis. It is presumptive based on the language of the statute and based on the case law, both from this court and from the Nevada Supreme Court.
Is there a concern that because the domestic violence or child abuse was not considered, that the other best interest factors may not have been considered appropriately, and that if it's all reweighed, that may result in a different outcome?
Yes, absolutely. It may result in a different outcome, especially because this factor is presumptive, right? The starting point is that it tilts in the favor of appellant, and it's clear from the record that the district court did not view the analysis in that manner. And, you know, this court has made clear, and the statute makes clear, that it is within the district court's discretion to award custody to an abusing parent, but it has to go through the required analysis, and it has to show its work, which includes making findings related to the abuse that went on, and then also making specific findings that show that the child will be adequately protected for if they are placed in the custody of the abusing parent. So the district court had a responsibility to make those findings and to ensure that the youngest minor child was adequately protected for if she was going to be placed into respondent's custody. And the district court failed to do that here. You know, in its initial custody order, or even again, when really it had a second bite at the apple, when there was, you know, motions that were filed after the custody decree was entered to try and get the court to consider this abuse again. The district court in that subsequent order, again, did no analysis at all regarding the best interests or any analysis at all regarding the abuse that went on. And really that's, you know, kind of the biggest concern here is that appellant at all stages throughout the proceeding was basically begging the court to consider these allegations of abuse, to at least, you know, consider it as part of the best interest analysis, and that was not done here. So in addition to that, you know, what is also concerning here is that many of the best interest factors, if the court would have considered them, tilt in the favor of appellant based on the record that's before us and then was before the district court. You know, one of the factors talks about abuse by one of the parents, and here the district court failed to consider the abuse either in the context of the presumption or in the context of the best interest analysis. There's also a factor that talks about the developmental and emotional needs of the child, and here there was testimony from appellant about how well the youngest minor child was doing in school, how she enjoyed the activities that she was in, and was really flourishing in the environment that she was in. And so the district court should have conducted some analysis about how it would affect the child to be uprooted out of the only life that she's known here in Nevada and placed into an unfamiliar environment, an unfamiliar school in Colorado. There should have been some analysis about how that would affect her. And there should have been some analysis about how it would affect her ability to maintain a relationship with her sisters, since that is another factor under the statute as well. So the district court really abrogated its duty to consider those kinds of best interest factors when it awarded custody of the youngest minor child to respondent. And so for those reasons, the failure to conduct the best interest analysis and the failure to apply the rebuttable presumption as it relates to the abuse, appellant would ask that this court reverse the district court's order with instruction for it to conduct the analysis required under the statute related to both of those issues.
Does that mean a new evidentiary hearing?
I don't think that there needs to be a new evidentiary hearing, Your Honor, especially because, you know, this evidentiary hearing that was conducted, there was testimony elicited by, you know, from both of the parties that related to the best interest factors, and the district court here just failed to consider the evidence, both abuse and then the other best interest factors.
But didn't your client want to testify about it, too, and the court cut her off?
She did. So, you know, I think there would have been more that came out related to the abuse if she would have been allowed the chance. But with the record that's in front of us, again, all that we have is evidence substantiating the abuse in the form of the report. And then we have absolutely no attempt at all by respondent to refute that abuse. So in a way, I would say respondent has waived his ability to, you know, refute the abuse. So if the court was going to remand for a new evidentiary hearing, I would say that it'd be limited and not to relitigate those you know allegations of abuse or those statements of abuse since respondent had that opportunity.
Do you have a question still?
No, I think okay. He answered it.
All right, you can reserve the rest of your time then for rebuttal. Thank you very much, Mr. Cardenas.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, the respondent, Ms. Cohen.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Leslie Cohen, representing the respondent. To begin with, we do agree that this was an initial custody determination. At the trial in this matter, the appellant did not introduce any evidence of domestic violence against the children. This was despite the fact that the trial order was clear about the requirements of a pretrial memo, an exhibit list, an exchange of exhibits, and generally how to proceed with the trial, as well as a referral to the self-help center for litigants who were new to coming to court and needed extra help. Appellant failed to do any of this. Appellant did not file a list of exhibits nor a pretrial memo. Appellant did not bring any evidence to trial. The only action appellant took in an attempt to prove at trial that domestic violence occurred against the children was apparently referencing minutes from another state's court that were attached to her motion pleadings a couple of times. And that simply isn't sufficient to prove that there was domestic violence in this case. At trial, appellant did not testify that she witnessed domestic violence against the party's children. In fact, from my review of the record, she didn't appear to have made any reference in the record to having witnessed domestic violence.
Counsel Cohen, what is the standard of review that we should use to address the domestic violence issues?
Clear and convincing, Your Honor.
What about under the best interest factors? What's the standard of review?
Well, I believe it's clear and convincing to be able to prove that this happened. So during the trial, a parent did not even state that there was a conviction and only referenced charges of domestic violence.
So I think that the question was about the standard of review on appeal.
Right.
So abuse of discretion or de novo.
I'm sorry, abuse of discretion.
And then as to the trial court, the clear and convincing as to the presumption, but it's just a regular preponderance of the evidence for the best interest factor, not including the presumption.
Right. I'm sorry, I was a bit confused, yes.
No, four different standards we're talking about here now.
No, I you're not confused. Okay. I did want to ask what the standard of review was for domestic violence.
Okay.
And you've indicated it was clear and convincing, but if we look at the best interest factors, isn't that by preponderance of the evidence that the court should have considered the information related to domestic violence?
Yes, Your Honor, but it wasn't presented to the court, is what my argument is.
Wasn't there evidence of that in the family mediation centers?
Right, and I will address that, Your Honor. I wanted to go through what mom presented, and then I'll go through what the children presented. So getting back to mom, what mom argued about not being permitted to testify about domestic violence at trial, that simply isn't the case. At trial, she failed to address her allegations of domestic violence until after the district court stated its ruling, after the parties concluded their case in chief.
Well, counsel, didn't the court specifically say, I'm going to control the questioning so that we don't waste time? The court directed the questioning and did not ask her a single question about domestic violence.
However, the judge repeatedly gave her that opportunity to make statements and to testify to what she wanted. Going back to the beginning of the trial, he was clear in a statement at the beginning, quote, Ms. Crozier, could you please tell me what it is you want the court to do and why I should do it, end quote. She responded that she wanted full custody of the children. And when the district court asked her if she understood what that meant, they had a conversation about the definition. When the court asked appellant what she next wanted, instead of taking the opportunity to discuss domestic violence and the decision she wanted based on her argument of domestic violence, she moved on to child support. Then, when the district court finished asking her, asking the respondent questions, he said to appellant, quote, Mother, I'm going to give you the same opportunity if you feel the need to ask any questions of the father go ahead and do so at this time. And instead of using that opportunity for her to ask, were you convicted of domestic violence, or bring up the allegations of domestic violence, she just said, quote, honestly, at this time, I don't have any real questions.
How long was this hearing?
I believe it was an after, it wasn't a full day trial, is my understanding. It was 122 pages. I'm sorry, Your Honor, that's the way I think of it from reviewing the transcript. But I can look at the transcript and get you the actual time if you'd like.
When it became clear to the court that she did have domestic violence concerns when she raised her argument, why couldn't the court have reopened testimony at that point? The court was the one that closed testimony and said, we're done now.
Right. And he also, again, said to her, quote, Ms. Crozier, go ahead and tell me what it is you want to give me the factual evidence that you believe substantiates me doing what you want me to do. So, and her response was, quote, okay, I'd like sole legal and physical custody of the children. I feel at this time that Mr. Crozier, with his prior child abuse charges and the way the girls have acted, end quote. So she never used the opportunities to provide evidence of domestic violence. She didn't take those opportunities to follow the court rules, to follow what she was offered when she was offered to ask questions, where she could have asked questions about domestic violence, where she could have testified. She just did not address those issues.
Did the district court consider that she hadn't properly followed procedure to deny her the ability to talk about domestic violence, or did the court actually ask her about it, independent of the fact that maybe she didn't follow the procedures correctly?
Right. As far as I recall, the district court did not ask her specific questions. I believe the district court asked, have you provided evidence or something along those lines? But he didn't specifically ask her those questions.
Is it your position that the district court did not have sufficient information to make a decision or to at least analyze the best interest factor regarding domestic violence when the court prepared its order?
Right. I think the judge clearly read the child interview. He was very, very moved by that child interview, and he references it repeatedly. And I believe at one point, mom starts to testify about something about the oldest daughter wanting to get out of high school early and why she wanted to do that. And he was so familiar with that report that he contradicted her and said, no, that's not why she said she wanted to do that. And he talked about how through his practice, the years of his practice, he had seen very few interviews that were as upsetting as that interview. I'm paraphrasing, but generally, again, if you review the transcript, he knows that interview. He's very well versed on that interview, or interviews, I should say, since it's two children. I just think it didn't meet the standard for him. For whatever reason, he did not take away from that interview that domestic violence happened.
Do you think he should have considered that factor independently, because the court is required to look at all the best interest factors?
Right. I think he started to do the factors. It wasn't that he did none of the factors. It was that he started to do the factors, and then they seem to have gotten sidetracked speaking about the domestic violence. I think he still got to the decision he wanted to get to.
How can we affirm the district court's custody order where there are no best interest findings in the order or the post-custody decree?
Right. He did in the transcript, he did go through some of them.
Exactly.
I understand, Your Honor. The order did not include that. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't have an answer to that. I think he did orally make sufficient findings. He discussed which parent, went detailed into which parent is more likely to allow frequent communication and relationship for the child. And again, he continuously, throughout the proceedings discussed the parenting of both parents and his concerns about what they were doing. It's just when it was time to tie it up in a bow, he didn't take that final step, but it's in there in the transcript. He goes through many of those factors, even the children having a relationship. He discusses that about how exchanges are going to go and making sure the girls all get to see each other. He just doesn't say, I'm making a finding, I'm doing this, one, two, or A, B, C.
But the court didn't consider any evidence of domestic violence in its order.
No, it didn't. But it did, again, clearly he is very attuned to what is said in the interview, the interviews, and doesn't seem to have found that it met the clear and convincing standard.
Under Nevada laws, right. And he required to do that.
Yes, he is.
Thank you.
What about any findings related to relocation? Were there any?
Well, there were no findings related to relocation, but this was an initial custody case.
Right, but there's still the Druckmann case that came out the year before the right. Statutes were amended in 2015. And, I mean, between the custody best interest, sometimes that can help out on the relocation best interest finding, but here we don't have either one.
Right.
Is your position none were needed for the relocation?
I think he was considering the pre-Druckmann and the fact that they had also relocated with mom from another state. The case started in Utah, and I don't know if that's what the justice court or the district court was thinking of. Now I do want to point out that their appellant hasn't shown that any other factors would have been in her favor if the district court had voiced its opinion regarding each one, and that's a review of such factors by the district court would have tipped the scale in her favor. The district court was really clear about its concerns about the way all of the children were being raised and the way the parties referred to each other in front of the children and to the children. The district court also addressed cooperation between the parties despite not making an actual finding regarding this factor. So with that, appellant hasn't shown that but for the alleged error of not going through every single custody factor on the record, the district court would have ruled in her favor. As far as the allegation about waiver, I do want to comment there was no evidence of the domestic violence outside of what could be said from the interview, which was admitted into evidence. There were minutes that were in the file, but were not admitted at the time of trial. But to be clear, those minutes were of a nolo plea from another state that were not admitted into this case. So should the matter be remanded, as far as domestic violence and any presumptions with a conviction, the respondent should not have to proceed as if that's already been confirmed by the court, because he didn't have a chance to address that at trial. It wasn't like the minutes were admitted and then he should have said, oh, hold on, judge, that's nolo under NRS, that doesn't count. Those were never presented at the time of trial. So again, he can't waive what wasn't even argued. Court's indulgence. Therefore, I would argue that reversal is not warranted and that any failure by the court to address the factors should be considered harmless error. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cohen. Hey, Mr. Cardenas. I think you heard the point that Ms. Cohen made at the end here. She said initially that it wasn't shown by Ms. Crozier that the other factors would have been in her favor, and that if there was any error, it was harmless.
Right. So to that point, Your Honor, I would just clarify that the standard of review on appeal for a custody determination is an abuse of discretion. This court and the Nevada Supreme Court have made clear that's an abuse of discretion, and that this court still has a duty to determine whether the district court reached its conclusion for appropriate reasons and must ensure that custody orders are supported by substantial evidence. And I think it's important that the Supreme Court has also said that deference is not owed to legal error or to findings so conclusory that they mask legal error. And then when it comes to legal questions, this court can review de novo. And I think there's a little bit of a crossover there, because the record here, there was no substantial evidence to support the district court's order. So I think it was an abuse of discretion. And I think it's also clear from the case on the statute that the district court has a duty to make specific findings related to the best interest factors. And with the record that was before it, it had a duty to apply the rebuttable presumption. So in that regard, it was an error of law. So I think there's a little bit of overlap there, but it would not be harmless error. And I have not seen a custody case where the court applies the harmless error standard. Additionally, I would just point back to the point that was raised by respondent about appellant not raising this issue during the evidentiary hearing. We'll admit that maybe appellant could have more artfully raised the issue, but really throughout the course of the proceedings, when we look at the record, she was begging the district court to consider this abuse, right? In different ways, she was just asking the court to consider this abuse, and really the district court had a responsibility to address it head on. I think that's clear from case law like Castle v. Simmons from the Nevada Supreme Court and from Nance v. Ferrero from this court, that really the district court has a duty to address that evidence head on and really conduct the analysis if it's going to award custody to an abusing parent. And additionally, another point the respondent raised about the district court relying on some of the statements in the report, I think that kind of shows the district court's analysis was internally contradictory, right? It relied on certain statements in the report by the children that supported the analysis the district court wanted to make and the determination it wanted to make, but then it completely ignored all of the statements about the abuse. So based on the district court's failure to conduct the best interest analysis and the failure to apply the rebuttable presumption, we ask that this court reverse with the district court for instruction for the district court to conduct those analyses. Thank you.